You are listening to
Extinction Radio. Get the podcast at extinctionradio.net.
So let the gangster-esque rap music paint a picture, and I'll hit you with some evidence-based predictions. Get ready for wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC.
To welcome back to Extinction Radio, Derek Jensen. Hi, Derek. Are you there?
Hey, I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for agreeing to do the interview. We've also got sitting alongside us the wonderful Jennifer Hines, well known for her videos on methane. So check what they called, Jennifer, just remind us quickly.
Initially it was the Arctic Methane Monster's Rapid Rise, and then a year later, The Demise of the Arctic, Methane Monster 2.
Right, well, there you go. So if you want to find out about those, just go to YouTube, put that in, and you can watch them. Now, the first thing I want to ask you, Derek, is I've heard through the grapevine that you've got a new book coming out, and it's called Monsters. And recently, just today, I watched your latest little video about it on YouTube, and I was really impressed with the illustrations that the book contains. Do you want to tell us all about Monsters and how you're funding it and what the book's about? And I'll just let you take it from there, mate.
Well, thank you. The book started, probably 5 or 6 years ago when I was doing a local book signing and someone came up to me and handed me a pile of books that she had illustrated and said, I love your work and I'd love to work with you. And honestly, I get people asking me if they can work with me all the time, and I have to turn most of them down, almost all of them, because I don't have time, and also for reasons we'll see in a second.
Right.
But I looked at her art, and it was I really liked it. It was excuse me. I'll be coughing throughout. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. You've had a bad cold, haven't you? You know, you're just getting over it. So yeah. Carry on there, yeah.
So, but I liked her work, and she lives locally, so we decided to get together for lunch a couple times and discuss what project we would try to work on together. Because I do like collaborating when it works. And her stuff is kind of creepy, so what we came up with that we would do is I would write a collection of stories on the theme of monsters, and then she would illustrate them. And I wrote the stories to be illustrated. I wrote them specifically for that, and I wrote them, and we'll talk about the stories in a minute. But anyway, I wrote the stories over about 9 months, and then I was sending them to her, and she was saying, they're great, I love them. And I'll start on the painting soon. And then after the 9 months, I would write to her every month or two, and she would say, I'll start on the painting soon. And then she started saying, I'll start on them sometime. And then she stopped writing back. And this is one reason that I am try to be careful with the people with whom I collaborate, because I basically wasted 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I just sat on it for a few years, and then I got inspired to write several more stories. And I think some of the best ones in the piece were written a few years later. And then I decided to make it a collaborative effort, that I just sent out a call saying, so would people like to illustrate this? And we will work together. And I don't remember how many people ended up sort of making the final cut on that, 12 or 13 and 10, 8, somewhere, 8 or 9, some around 10 illustrators. And their stuff's just fantastic. And then we decided to split up the illustrations. There's three illustrations per story. And the process of doing it was pretty fun too, because it was an example of how people can work together. That what I did is I made a grid of, actually a friend of mine made the grid, because I'm completely computer incompetent, but a friend of mine made a grid that had every story written along the top. Like there's a story about a vampire and a story about three stories about trolls, a story about an orc, story about skeleton. We'll talk about those in a minute.
Yeah.
And we put the grid along the top, and then down below was first illustration, second illustration, third illustration. And then we sent it out, and people would fill in what they wanted to do on the grid and then send it back to me. And if there were multiple people wanting to do it, I just turned it over to them and said, you figure out between you who does what. And we talk, and I said, if there is a conflict about this, then I'm going to resolve it because it's my project and I'll just choose.
Yeah.
But the real point is that there weren't any conflicts, and
yeah,
everybody just chose, everybody worked together. It's like they actually learned what they were supposed to learn in kindergarten about working together.
Yep. And lovely.
So it all worked great. It was, there are some problems with anarchism that we don't need to discuss today. But this was not one of them. This was a great example of everybody doing what they're supposed to do, mutual cooperation, et cetera, et cetera. So then they started sending in the illustrations, and they were just fabulous. I loved them. And so then, and also, here's why there's a GoFundMe, is because I'm publishing it myself, and also it was very important to me that the illustrators, that the artists be paid for their work, because we hear so often that's one of the things, the internet has made this even worse, that there's a cliche about writing that's also true about other forms of art, which is writing is a great way to make a life and a terrible way to make a living. And I wasn't going to contribute to the idea that artists should not be paid for their work. So they're being paid, not a lot, but they're being paid. And,
right. So, I mean, I got a glimpse. I got a little glimpse, and I tried to sneakily, stop YouTube and pause it. And because I just saw how fantastic these images were as they scrolled down, you know, they scrolled down on the YouTube thing you did. I can recommend, even if you don't want to read Derek's words, just buy it for these illustrations. They're absolutely wonderful. So maybe you could tell us a bit about, the stories now, Derek. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd be glad to. There are these things called fractured fairy tales, which are, they take standard fairy tales and they change them to sort of change the moral. And I wanted to do this with these stories of monsters, where I wanted to turn everything on its head and articulate, I guess, since I can't say illustrate because that's what they're doing, articulate a different perception on them, to ask who are the real monsters. Because, of course, this culture is killing the planet. And at the same time, I wanted to make sure, I mean, I like scary stories. I enjoy reading Stephen King. And so I wanted to make sure the stories were, I hope, a little bit scary too. And so one story, for example, is about a vampire. And in what that story is a philosophy graduate student goes to interview a vampire. And I had tremendous fun with this because the vampire is incredibly narcissistic. And we all know that philosophy graduate students are among the most narcissistic people on the planet. So the two of them sort of have this competition as to who can out-narcissist the other. That's one story. There's a story about a skeleton. It's about a character who goes to – a guy who goes to an amusement park, and he sees this one performance that's sort of like Pirates of the Caribbean or something, except it's a skeleton giving a speech.
Right.
And the genesis for that story was that someone had sent me, a very smart woman had sent me her analysis of anorexia and how anorexia is about body hating and nature hating and woman hating. And so in this story, what is the ultimate, anorexia would be a skeleton. And not only is a skeleton, it combines with the whole culture. This is a mechanical skeleton, which manifests the, manifests perfectly the hatred of the embodied, the hatred of the body. So that story explores that. There is a story about a were creature who kills others. And I don't want to say more about that story because it has a twist ending. That story, when I was a kid, I loved reading sort of O. Henry stories. And also Frederick Brown was one of my favorite writers when I was a young teen.
Right.
And he's known for writing stories that have a twist at the end. So I can't tell you more about the were creature story, because the point of that story is the twist.
That's fine.
There's a story called Monsters. I think I can talk a little bit about this one that starts with a character. You find this out very quickly is why I can say it. It starts with a character who is a perfectly nice family person and he's treating his family very well and everybody's all happy and pleased. This only goes on for a couple, three pages. And then you find out that he is the commandant of a death camp. And then it switches to the perspective, and I'm going to ruin one thing here, but I'll try not to do too many spoilers. And the next section is about some creatures getting gassed, and then you find out at the end of that section that the creatures getting gassed are not human beings, but instead prairie dogs who the holes to their entries to their homes have been shut up and gas pellets were tossed in. And then the next section after that is of a human who is talking to the exterminator about killing the prairie dogs to put in a mall.
Right.
And so that one, that's sort of a classic example of the inversion that's going on through a lot of the book of who are the monsters. And on that, you know, I don't want to make this too sort of intellectual or academic because they really are stories and that's the whole point is the story.
Yeah.
I was really influenced heavily by, for example, the work of Jane Caputi and other feminists, Mary Daly, who write about, they take the myths of this culture and they turn them on their head and show how they were propagating patriarchal values. So a great example would be Medusa is slain by Jason. She's the monster, but the truth is that this was a story, or another one would be the killing of Tiamat, the dragon, by, I don't remember who, some Western hero. And both of those are really stories of the ascendancy of patriarchy. And so I wanted to start turning all this stuff on its head for those political reasons, but to do it in an entertaining and one hopes scary way.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. I might actually get the book and read some of the words, Derek. Because, you know, I just read one author at the moment, and his name is Terry Pratchett. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Have you ever heard that name?
I've heard that name. I might have read a book. What does that person write?
Well, he's a comic genius, basically, and he writes mainly about a place called the Discworld. It's science fantasy, and that is the only books I read. He's written about 50 of them. And once I finish the 50, I go back and start again. I'm just a bit weird that way, you know. But they make me laugh, and I like to laugh. And he's a comic genius, so I might step out of this little bubble, Terry Pratchett bubble that I'm in, and read your book because it sounds fun, and certainly with the illustrations alongside it, I mean, it sounds like it's a complete article. So do you want to tell us sort of? About, you know, the crowdfunding thing a little bit and how to help with that.
Well, sure. And before we do, I just want to say, want to ruin the streak. You know, I mean, if you've gone years with this, maybe just look at the pictures and don't read it. Cause I don't want you to like, if you have a streak, like, you know, when Joe DiMaggio had his, 56 game hitting streak, you don't want to ruin a streak. So if you've gone years without reading a book, you shouldn't read that book.
Well, I'll put it this way. I'm not going to promise that I'll read it, you know, but I'll certainly look at the illustrations.
Does looking at the illustrations count as reading another book, or does that not count?
It half counts. Let's leave it at that.
Oh, okay. Well, think about it then. So the GoFundMe campaign is on GoFundMe, and you can just search for my name there. It's really not. Here's another thing that's kind of weird is I'm very, well, proud, and that I don't want to, I feel uncomfortable, and maybe this is just weird, I feel uncomfortable taking charity from people, so it's not actually a GoFundMe campaign as such.
Right.
What it is an opportunity for people to pre-order the book. And not only do they pre-order the book, but they'll get more than they pay for. For example, for $25, which is going to be the cover price of the book, is going to be $25. For $25, they get a copy of Monsters, and they get a copy of one other book from a list that's on the page. So they actually are getting, for pre-ordering, they're getting Monsters plus a book. Or for $50, they get Monsters and three other books from the list. And it's not all of my books. It's just some of the books.
Right. And they're getting, this time they're getting a whole art gallery as well.
Exactly. So it's actually, and I feel like we're on some sort of, I don't know if you have these in the UK, but over here we have PBS runs these, fundraising campaigns all the time. And it's really embarrassing. They'll say, okay, we're going to watch a BBC Mystery in a Movement, but right now, if you send in $75, you can get a mug. And anyway, so I feel a little bit like a huckster, but the truth is, once again, that people are actually getting more value for their money than they would if they just waited and bought the books later.
And so, Derek, what is that webpage that people can go to if they want to, you know, pre-order this book and get this great deal?
They go to GoFundMe.com, and then they search for my name. I'm going to go ahead and give you the whole URL, but nobody's going to remember this. It's GoFundMe.com/monsters-stories-by-Derek-Jensen. So just go to GoFundMe and search for Derek Jensen and you'll find it.
Okay, that's terrific. Because I certainly want to go there and order this. I think this book sounds absolutely fascinating. Think it'll be a great success.
Thank you. And looking on the page, it says here that there's 9 artists, 48 original illustrations. And that's frankly where, so the money goes to the artist. It also goes to pay the editors, to pay the designer, and also to pay for printing. Cause printing a full color book is way, way more expensive than printing a non full color book.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the quality of that printing looked really good to me as well. You know, so it's a win-win situation, folks. You know, go to that link and you know, go for one of Derek's two options, you won't be disappointed.
Oh,
there's more options. Give us them.
Oh yeah, okay. There's $25, $50. That $75 is you get the Monsters and 5 books. $100, you get 5 books, Monsters, and you get a year of membership in what I call my reading club, which is where people get to read stuff as I write it. I'm working on, 3 other books right now? And they get to read them in process. I'll talk about that in a minute. For $200, they get 5 books from the list. Oh, and I just have to say also that if they're in the UK, or if they're out of the United States, they also have to pay postage, because otherwise international postage is just crazy. I wish – this is a small thing, but – I'm still kind of annoyed that they got rid of surface international mail about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You could order stuff internationally and it would only cost maybe $7 or $8. It would take 3 months to get there, but it was cheap. And international postage is just outrageous. What I suppose we should be happy for, because anything that will slow international trade is a good thing.
Yeah.
For $200, they get all that plus an hour-long Skype call. For $500, they get all of that plus they get to name a character in my next novel.
I think that you better plan on having a lot of characters, and many people will want the $500 option, I'm sure.
Actually, several people have. It's pretty cool. I might have to write multiple novels to work them all in. and we can talk about that novel too if you want. It's not even started, and it won't be started. I have to finish a book I'm working on and then write another book after that, and then I'm going to do that novel.
Right. So when is Monsters due out? Have you got a publishing date?
Yeah, it'll be out in August. We've started the printing process. It's at the printers and I think early August is when, sometime in August is when I'm supposed to get the books.
Right. And you'll be able to, they'll be in all your local bookstores and available on Amazon and whatever, hopefully.
Yeah, all those things too.
All that sort of stuff added on. So, hey.
Fabulous.
That's
fabulous.
Incredible, the amount of options you've got there.
Yeah,
that's stunned me.
It's rather stunning.
Yeah, are you satisfied with, what you said about Monsters, or would you like to continue, Derek?
Let me take a quick look at the table of contents and see if I want to mention another book. Oh, another thing, and this is not a sales pitch here, this is just something I find really interesting, is I love hearing little anecdotes about how writers wrote their book, or how musicians wrote their song. Like, for example, I still remember this from hearing this, God, 40 years ago now, that, the Lynyrd Skynyrd song, Freebird, the way they wrote that song, you know, no matter what somebody thinks of it, the way they wrote that song was they had a guitar jam that was all by itself that people thought was okay, but no big deal. And they also had this ballad that they really liked, but audiences thought was boring. And then one night it occurred to them, if they combined the ballad would lead into the guitar jam, then they'd have a song. And
right.
My point is, I find stories like that. Or I just heard this one the other day about the song, Pinball Wizard.
Yeah.
That, Pete Townsend hates that song, and he thinks the song's a piece of crap, and he wrote it in about 15 minutes. Fully expecting for it not to be included on the album Tommy. And I love stories like that. And so my point is that, I wrote all these stories, and then at the end of the book, I have,
all the anecdotes, yeah?
All the anecdotes about the different stories,
that's an added extra.
Whether somebody else finds that fascinating or not, I just love it.
Again,
Stephen King.
I find those kind of things fascinating as well.
I want to talk about one more story. I
go
love
on
this
on,
story.
Go on then.
It's one of my favorite stories in the book. It's in some ways one of the funnest stories for me. It's called Demon Spawn, and it's about she's probably 15, a 15-year-old girl who's at a high school, who is, I'll just read the beginning of it. And I love the tone of this story. It's all written from her perspective. I'm sick of it. I'm so sick of it. All the kids chant, demon spawn, demon spawn. They think it's funny, but don't they understand? I didn't choose my parents. I can't help it if my dad's Asmodeus and my mom's Astarte. I'm a good kid. I get straight A's. I play the flute in the marching band. Do I get credit for that? No, of course not. I'm just demon spawn. Okay, I get it. I'm kind of a geek. I've never been on a date. Can you believe what the parents I have? I've never had a date. And can you believe with them being the demon and demoness of love, or as the Christians put it, lust, they haven't pushed me into a relationship? My problem isn't my parents. They both keep telling me when the time's right, I'll find somebody. But how can I find somebody when everybody calls me demon spawn all the time? It's not like I have cloven hooves and I keep my tail hidden under my skirt. Some kids call me fire and brimstone. I hate it so much. If I told my father, he'd drag them off to hell. But I'm a resort if I don't have to. Just imagine what effect that would have on my social life. They call me fire and brimstone because of what happened one time in physical ed. That snooty Evelyn Ray was holding my feet while I did sit-ups. I was already hot and sweaty and wearing those awful gym shorts to keep my tail smashed against my body. I was tensing my abs to raise up, and I couldn't help it. I farted. Just a tiny little squeak. That could have happened to anybody. Well, Evelyn, and since then I've called her Evil Lynn, shrieked and started using that name. It caught on. I've tried to tell her that, and everybody else, that everybody's farts smell like sulfur, but it doesn't feel good. Anyway, so I love that story. I love this kid's voice.
Oh my God. Everybody has to go out and buy this instantly. This is going to be a bestseller. I love it.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely love it. Hey, if you don't mind, we have some, questions that have come in from our community, and, like to read a question from Andrew Beck. And he has a question for you. He says, after reading A Language Older Than Words, I realized that many people come to an understanding of the world they live in through personal trauma. For others, trauma shuts down their responses. So he really wants to know if you see trauma as a reason why some people shut down rather than wake up, and also, he wants to understand about mass trauma and how that can be dealt with to help people. So can you speak a little bit about trauma and, you know, whether it shuts you down or opens you up, and what you think about that?
Oh, my God, that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
That is the question.
Sorry.
So in my 30s, yeah. I interviewed both, not together, separately, I interviewed Robert J. Lifton and Judith Herman. Robert J. Lifton is probably the world's foremost authority on the psychology of genocide. He's written extensively, he wrote The Nazi Doctors, which is a fabulous book. He's written extensively about how and why people commit atrocities and the effects of those atrocities. And Judith Herman is the author of Trauma and Recovery, which is an absolutely extraordinary book. She is one of the people, one of the primary people who came up with the diagnosis of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD is where you're traumatized once. You're in an earthquake, or you are sexually assaulted once, or some terrible, terrible thing happens and you're traumatized. And she said, what happens if you're not just traumatized once, but it's ongoing? For example, if you're a prisoner, or if you are a victim of domestic violence, if you are living under a horribly repressive regime, those will change you much more than simple PTSD, cause long-lasting changes in your personality, which we can talk about or not if you want. But the point is, individually, I was interviewing each of those, and I asked each one of them, so we know that some people shut down from trauma, and some people open out from trauma, and some people do both at the same time. So why is it that some people open out and some people shut down? And they both individually had the same response, which is they both laughed and said, God, I wish I knew. And these are the two world's experts on trauma. It's like, we don't know why some people, after they go through a horrible trauma, they end up – why do some people end up passing on the trauma – and some people end up taking what Judith Herman calls a survivor mission to stop the trauma and to stop the furthering of the trauma. Who knows? And we can probably try to make up some, we can probably try to find some commonalities of why some people open up and some people shut down. But I just needed to get that out of the way, that the two world's experts on this, I asked them that part of the question and neither one had any idea. Ultimately, this is what, I don't remember if Judith Herman wrote about this or if this was, Viktor Frankl or Erich Fromm, but one of those was writing about this, saying that in many ways, you know, when you're going through trauma, that's one of the questions that you end up coming to is why, and to which there is no real answer. I mean, we can come up with tangible answers of, you know, a lot of the serial sex killers were themselves abused as children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this, I used to teach at a prison, and we hear all the time that, prisoners, that the pedophiles don't do well in prison, that they are often beaten by other prisoners. And when I was teaching my students, they were very clear that the reason, and nobody ever talks about the reason that pedophiles are so often abused in prison. And a lot of my students were saying, that's because that's why we're in here. We know that our life was messed up completely by an abusive parent. And when we find somebody who's abusing a kid, we're taking out our own rage right. and frustration for the fact that I'm spending the rest of my life in prison. And they say, yes, I recognize I did terrible things, but like this one guy came up to me one time, he was writing stories about just whatever he was writing about. And he came up to me and he said, you know, I just realized writing this story why I'm so mean. And it was because his grandfather beat the hell out of him basically every day when he was a kid. And, you know, this was my experience of teaching in prisons is I'm not a prison abolitionist. There are people who scared me in there. There were some people, if you keep them off of heroin, they would be perfectly fine neighbors. You know, the drugs just, or if you come up with a decent way for them to live without addiction, they would be perfectly fine people. Some of them were like that.
Yeah.
It's like I have a friend who says she thinks that, people who are arrested for drugs should be sentenced to college. And I kind of agree with that.
Yeah.
Because there is this desperation. But having said all that, some of my students were just plain creepy. You know, they were so destroyed that they cannot be in society. And
is there any hope of a sort of rehabilitation of some sort, do you think, for these people? Or did they just get left in a cell and did they just left to their craziness?
Oh, there's for a lot of especially the lifers, there's not a lot of rehabilitation. Mm. But my point was going to be that honestly, in a lot of those cases, the people who should have been in prison are their parents. Because I had students who were put out to prostitution at the age of 4.
Yeah, or indeed their parents' parents. You know, I mean, how far does it you trace it back?
And you know, I'm not a big fan of the Bible, and I'm guessing neither of you probably are either. But there's that great line about the sins of the fathers being visited under the children for seven generations or however many generations. Mm. That's a very wise statement. Mm-hmm. And that's how trauma propagates. And so can you ask me the question again? Because I've gone in all sorts of directions, so I want to come back to the question itself.
Yeah, well, the basic thought is, you know, with trauma, people can respond in a variety of ways. So some people shut down, and for other people, it's something they kind of triumph over, and it's really a cause for growth, because it can hit people a few different ways. And I kind of want to add on to it now, because this is really in light of the extinction crisis that we're currently embarking upon. And we're going to experience mass trauma. So, you know, given mass trauma, we need to be able to face this and come out of this in a better way. And, you know, there's a couple of ways that this can go. So maybe if you could speak about support in the light of mass trauma and how we can kind of see the better side of it. If you know what I mean.
Well, one of the things that Judith Herman said to me is that if somebody is in a trauma-inducing situation, the first thing you need to do is get them out of it. They have to be put into safety. And because if they're not, then pretty much everything else you're doing is, if the trauma's ongoing, it's ongoing. And you can't really recover much then. So the first thing is to get people to safety. And or non-human people too, to safety. And the next thing is that Judith Herman is very big on the importance of, making meaning of the trauma story through telling it in a supportive atmosphere where you can make meaning of it. And, a great example of this, and I talk about this in a book that I've got done that isn't published yet, is one of my students at prison, the crime he was in, well, I taught creative writing, and every one of his stories was the same. He would start by saying, this story is fiction, nothing like this ever happened to me, it's completely fiction, and then it would be a story about a little boy who was horribly beaten and sexually abused, and as he's reading this, beads of sweat are popping out on his forehead, and he would then finish the story and say, but of course nothing like that ever happened to me, this is pure fiction. Okay, fine. And then one day, I was already at the prison to teach and my classes got canceled. So my supervisor said, I'm going to teach you about records. Let's look at one student, to find out what the person did. And I said, okay. And the student, and I feel okay saying this because I'm not giving any indication of who he is.
Yeah.
What he was in for was, his neighbors, or not his neighbors, but some people he knew, kidnapped a woman and put her in their apartment and then brought him over. And the three of them then sexually assaulted the woman for a couple of hours. And the sexual assault was different than any I've ever heard of in that they didn't use penises or fingers to violate her. Instead, they did, if they were 5 years old or 4 years old, you'd think they were playing doctor. They did things like, put the blunt end of a pen up in her or attached an alligator clip to her ear. I mean, the sort of thing that once again, well, we'll get to this in a second. And then after a couple hours of this, she said, you know, I'm kind of sweaty now. Can I go home and shower? And they said, yes, you can, as long as A, you come back after you shower and B, you promise not to call the police. And she left. And of course she immediately called the police. And then this guy got arrested a couple days later, just walking around town. And he's now doing 40 years for this. And this sexual assault was just so weird. And I talked to this friend of mine who's a psychologist, and I told her about this, saying, I don't understand what happened. And even though I recognize that sexual assault is about power and not about sex as such, it's a sexualized form of manifesting power. And so it's not imperative that a penis be used to rape a woman. But my point is, I call this friend of mine and I say, I don't understand what just happened. And she said, well, pretend you are watching a preschool and and you saw one child doing this to another child. What would you think? And I said, I would think that the child had been sexually abused and was acting this out. And she said, are there any other indications that this guy was sexually abused? And I told her about the stories. And she said, well, there's your answer. And my point on telling this whole long story is that this is a bit teleological, but it's true that the stories of trauma will be told. And they can be told through a voice, through here's what happened to me, and here's how I can make meaning of it, and here's how I can transcend it. I can never get over it, but I can turn it into a gift for the community. I can. That's one of the basic parts of a hero story is you take your trauma, you take the difficult thing you did and you experienced and you turn it into a gift to the community. And, or you can also manifest this in physical reality, nilly-willy. You can manifest it in ways that are unhealthy.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that or not. But one more thing I want to say about this is that years ago, I interviewed Luis Rodriguez, who wrote the book Gang Days in L.A., La Vida Loca. He was a gang member who got out through the Literature of Revolution. One of the questions I asked him was, so why is it that kids stand on street corners, Mexican kids in his case, stand on street corners shooting at mirror images of themselves? How is that helping their oppression? And he said, well, for one thing, cops send them against each other, but leave that aside. One of the reasons these kids are shooting mirror images of themselves is because they want to die. And one of the reasons they want to die is because they're teenagers. And teenagers have to die because you have to die to your childhood to become an adult. So they have these impulses that they need to die, but nobody is telling them that this death is supposed to be spiritual and metaphorical. And so they're manifesting in the real world by shooting at mirror images. And this is part of the problem is I think this is – there are many reasons this culture is killing the planet. But one of the reasons this culture is killing the planet is because from the very beginning – I mean, for crying out loud, it's in the Bible, you know? From the very beginning, this has been a linear culture that has a beginning, middle, and end. And from the beginning, this culture with its separation from nature has been incredibly traumatizing. And we want for this trauma to end. We know that there has to be a death, but we don't understand that that could be the death of the culture. It could be a spiritual and metaphorical death. And so it gets enacted in the real world with the murder of the real planet. And so one of the things I think is absolutely crucial, this is why discourse, one reason discourse is so important to overcoming trauma, because we have to be able to talk about it in a way that makes sense of it in order to be able to move on. And that's not to say that all discussion of it is moving on. In fact, I think most, nearly all of this culture's philosophy and nearly all of how we in this culture use our brain power, and this is true both personally and on the larger social scale, nearly all of it is rationalizing our traumatic behavior, rationalizing our like Judith Herman talks about, one of the common effects of having complex PTSD, of having been raised in trauma, is, or raised as a prisoner, is you come to believe that all relationships are hierarchical, where the strong do as they will and the weak survive as they can. And I'm sorry, that describes capitalism. That describes the selfish gene theory. That describes this culture's entire perception of evolution and the notion of how evolution, the engine for evolution, which it believes is competition, where the strong do as they will and the weak get not driven extinct. As opposed to what I believe is that the culture is based, that the evolution is based primarily on cooperation, because if you exploit your land base and you harm your land base is going to be harmed and therefore won't support you as well. And this just seems so self-evident to me. But my point is that on every single level, from the most personal to the most intimate, I think most of our sexual attitudes are based on recapitulating this trauma, where men are hierarchical over women. And we could get into that or not. It doesn't matter. But the point is, from the most intimate levels to the most social levels, I think that we, for the most part, use our brains, use our brains to rationalize our pre-existing traumatic condition. So we create, so here's the deal. You create a father, I mean, you have an abusive father. So what you do is you create the Old Testament God, who's frankly a pretty abusive guy. And you have now created a larger system to rationalize your own traumatized behavior. And how do we get out of that? I mean, it's really hard work, and it's really years of introspection, years of reading, of having other people pull you along, you know, holding hands with other people, whether those are people in your life or whether they are therapists or whether they are people who wrote books. I mean, Judith Herman's book was so important to my understanding of this and to my working through my own trauma. So, you know, another line I want to bring up is this great line by, oh gosh, I can't remember his name right now. Czechoslovakian, Milan Kundera. Is he Czechoslovakian? Right. Anyway, Milan Kundera, the struggle against oppression is a struggle of memory against forgetting. That, this is one reason why, once again, articulation is so important, because trauma makes amnesiacs of us all. I love the way Judith Herman begins the book, Trauma and Recovery, is something about how atrocities are those things that are too terrible for words. This is the meaning of the word unspeakable. And so if we can articulate it, once again, see, that's one of the things that's so hard, is that the defenses that we have built up in the traumatic situation sort of take on a life of their own, and they want to live. They want to keep going, and they have to be talked down, those defense mechanisms, after they're no longer useful. It's like a psychologist was telling me one time about how if you're raised in a situation where you can be assaulted at every moment, it makes perfect sense to become manipulative, to try to move attention from yourself to your sibling so that your sibling gets beaten instead of you. It really becomes dog eat dog, every child for him or herself, if anything you do can cause you to be harmed. Now, if you're in a healthy emotional situation, that behavior is incredibly destructive and harmful, but it makes perfect sense within the traumatic situation. And those more than habits, can be very, they take incredible work to get through, which is one reason I don't think this culture is going to have a voluntary transformation, because it is such hard work on a personal level. And I don't see most people doing that personal work, much less do I see it happening on the social level.
Right. I mean, I have a pretty comprehensive answer there. And it kind of leads on to the next question, Derek, because the next question is from Lazar Morgan. And he says, at what juncture does militant resistance to the dominant culture become unavoidable? And how would you respond to that question itself? You know, the meaning of that question, would it make sense for you? Because I don't think there's any revolution on the horizon myself.
Well, I'm doing what I can to help bring it about.
Right, yeah.
And I think you've answered your own question. At what point does it become unavoidable?
Well, it was his question. It wasn't mine, you know.
His question.
Yeah. Does militant resistance to the dominant culture become unavoidable?
Well, I think never. And the reason I say that is because of our capacity for denial.
Right.
That if we use the word unavoidable – because people will be able to avoid this to the very end. One of the things that just breaks my heart is to read about the Holocaust, because even when there would be 1,000 people and 20 or 50 Germans with machine pistols shooting them, you know, one at a time in the head, at that point you're dead. You are already dead. And so you may as well rush them. And I'm not in any way blaming anybody for anything they did. I was sure blaming the Germans, but I'm not blaming any victim for anything that they did or didn't do, because it's a terrible, terrible situation. And there are certainly circumstances where if you're standing there with your 7-year-old child, maybe all you can do is give your 7-year-old child a lifetime's worth of love in the last 30 seconds. That I am not blaming any of them, but I'm saying it disheartens me because of the number who didn't resist. And even when all other options have been foreclosed, and I don't know why that is. I understand not resisting, and I do understand in some ways, because they've been beaten down so much that, you know, there is always the hope that they will run out of bullets at the last minute or something. But so the point is that most of us will avoid resistance to the last moment, militant resistance, any sort of resistance, frankly. And the good news is that that's not all of us. And if we ask the question instead, at what juncture does it become appropriate?
Yeah.
I think we could say, certainly at the killing of the last passenger pigeon 100 years ago. Certainly at the killing of the last wolf in the UK or in Britain. The killing of the last great auk, you know, we can, you know, how much do you want to lose before you fight back? That's the question.
Yeah.
And then I think, I mean, that's the thing, is I'm actually very much a peaceful person. I will do almost anything to avoid a conflict. And that doesn't alter the fact that I see the direction this culture is going, and I see that amphibians are disappearing. And, you know, I wrote an essay 7 or 8 years ago about how I'm known for wanting to bring down civilization. It's not because I don't like hot showers or Beethoven's Ninth. I want to bring it down because I can do simple math and I see the direction it's going. And there are stolid scientists who are saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish in 30 years. Mm-hmm. And you were just talking earlier about, the death of the Arctic. And mm-hmm. you're not going to fight back for the Arctic. And if you're not going to fight back for the oceans, then – so I was doing a talk many years ago. And after the talk, this guy came up to me and I had said that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And he said, you know, I don't think it's time to fight back yet. And I said, okay, that's fine. 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone. So you stop me when it's time. And I said 91%, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99, 100% of the fish in the oceans. And he said, it will never be time to fight back. And I said, in that case, we got nothing to say to each other. So the point is, what's the threshold? You know, we have our thresholds, and what is the threshold? And there must be some threshold for many people. And the important thing, I think, is to pick a threshold. And then when it blows past it, it's like, I would love to ask a lot of climate activists who are pushing, you know, wind and solar. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you give me a point at which parts per million – at which you're going to give up on that, and you'll say it's okay to bring down the whole system to save the planet. 410 parts per million, 420, 430, 440, 450, 600. What's the threshold? And by the way, we were talking earlier. This is a little bit less intense, but I think it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
That we were talking earlier about where writers get ideas, and you know, one of the things that's a thing I've used a lot. What's the threshold at which you finally fight back? Where I got that was from reading a book on the AIDS crisis back in – I read this in the early 90s. And there was a line – the book was – and the band played on by Randy Schiltz. And there was a line in there that somebody said to – I think the city council of San Francisco, how many people have to die of AIDS before you will call this an epidemic? Just give us a number. 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, doesn't matter what the number is. Give us a number, and when we reach it, we want you to call this an epidemic. I was like, man, that was a powerful rhetorical tool. I'm going to use that. Anyway, so that's where I got the idea for that. But it's really important. It's like, how bad do things have to get? Find a threshold. And here's the thing. When you're in an abusive situation, it is so easy to have boundary after boundary after boundary broken. You can say, okay, oh, this happens. I knew a woman in my 20s, and this happens to a lot of women. She said about her husband beat her. And it's like, okay, as long as you beat me on the body where I can wear short sleeve shirts, I can live with that. And then he beat her on the arms. And she's like, okay, I can wear long sleeve shirts as long as you don't beat me in the face. And then he beat her in the face. He's like, okay, as long as he doesn't rape me. And he raped her. And for her, that was the moment. It's like, okay, I'm done. But the point is, it's so easy in an abusive situation to keep letting your boundaries slide. That's the point of an abuser. I mean, that's one of the central things they do, is to violate every boundary, which is how the abusive culture works too. Violates every natural boundary. Anyway, the point is that pick a threshold and then find something you love. And it's like, defend it. You know, one more thing I want to say about this is we have nothing but contempt for those Germans who stood by and were decent Germans while the Nazis were perpetrating their atrocities. We have nothing but contempt for them. But today, when there is so much more at stake, even than 6 million Jews and 4 million other people, when there is the world itself at stake, the only planet in the universe we know that has life, when there is so much at stake, we are not resisting. And in fact, when people talk about resistance, other people have to say, either have to say, oh, well, the real way to resist is by living a nomadic lifestyle. It's like, that wouldn't have stopped the Germans. The real way to resist is by growing your own food. It's like, growing your own food's fine, but don't pretend that's resistance. Resistance is actual opposition to those in power. It's like, can you imagine a member of the Norwegian resistance in World War II going, how did you resist the Nazis? I grew turnips. Like, oh, for God's sake. Either that or they'll say, oh, but resistance is too late. You know, resistance is futile. We can never accomplish anything. And it's too late anyway. The culture is going to come down. Just let it go down on its own. And I have a response to that too, which is Henning von Treskow. Henning von Treskow was a member of the resistance, the German resistance. He was a member of the German military. And part of the resistance against Hitler. He attempted to assassinate Hitler a couple times. He was in all the plots. And when D-Day came, the German resistance had an existential crisis because they knew the war is over. You know, Germany, Hitler's now lost. So why should we risk our lives to bring down Hitler when Hitler's on the way out anyway?
Yeah.
And Henning von Treskow, I'm going to find this real fast because it's so good.
Maybe I should sing Freebird while you're at it, you know?
I'm sorry, what?
Maybe I should sing Freebird until you find it, you know?
Oh, there you go. Okay, he said, by the time Stauffenberg was appointed chief of staff of the reserve army, ready to carry out the assassination attempt, the Allies had already landed in Normandy. When Stauffenberg sent a message to Treskow to ask whether there was any point in making the attempt since there was no practical purpose to be served, Treskow urged him not only to attempt the assassination, but to go ahead with a coup in Berlin. He argued that there must be an overt act of German opposition to Hitler regardless of the consequences. He also told somebody else that 16,000 people were being killed daily, not as casualties of war, but from being murdered by the Germans. And Hitler had to be killed to put an end to it. And so the point is there are 16 – every day they could stop the war earlier was 16,000 less people. Fewer casualties, fewer civilian casualties. And it's the same. There are 200 species being driven extinct every single day. Every day this culture goes on is that much more, that much weaker the planet is. And we need to pursue this. And then he also said that one of the reasons, one of the last things he said before he killed himself after the plot failed is, God promised Abraham that he would not destroy Sodom if only 10 righteous men could be found in the city. And so I hope for our sake, God won't destroy Germany. And his point was that, and he also said elsewhere that he was doing this to show the world that there were some decent people in Germany. And that is desperately important. And one of the reasons I do the work I do is because I want for the frogs to know that there are some decent human beings, and there are some human beings who care more for amphibians than they do the economic system. And that's who I'm writing for.
Right.
I don't really care what people think about me now. I care what the frogs think about me. And if there are any humans in the future, I care what they think about me. And honestly, the humans in the future aren't going to care about what we did. What they will care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. They'll care about whether the land can support them. This is true for human animals, and it's true for bear animals, and it's true for cedar animals, cedar plants. It's true for every being. That's what they're going to care about. And insofar as I can help bring that about, I don't care how it happens. I'm an absolute pragmatist. I don't care in the slightest. If holding hands and singing Kumbaya would save amphibians, I will do that.
Right.
Anyway, that's my answer to that.
Well, we kind of have a lead-on question that segues nicely into it. It's from a member of our community, Robert Dupuy. And it has to do with how is it that scientists and people like Al Gore believe we can fix this when all they can agree on is one thing, if we do the right thing. That is a very big if. What's the right thing when everything about climate change is accelerating? And how does he expect the world to do the right thing in time? It seems like that's kind of a question about bargaining and denial a little bit, not really assessing the situation, isn't it?
Well, and also I would suggest that Al Gore's idea of the right thing is different than mine. Al Gore's idea of the right thing is to put in solar and wind, which will not help the natural world. What needs to stop is the economic system that's killing the planet. That needs to be destroyed. I mean, this culture is waging war on the world, and the way you win a war is by destroying the enemy's capacity to wage war. Every military person understands this. And the point is not – see, there's a a huge coup has taken place in environmentalism, which is that at one point environmentalism was about saving wild places and wild beings. And somewhere along the way it got morphed into sustaining this culture,
yep,
which is killing the planet. And so you have all of these so-called environmentalists who are not actually about saving the wild places at all. What they're about is, okay, so you have a million people march in some city to stop global warming. And if you ask the individuals why they are doing this, a lot of them will say, we want to save the planet. And if you ask them what are their demands are they want subsidies for the wind and solar energy industries. That is a huge coup that has taken place. Can you think of any other mass movement for social justice that has had as its demands subsidies for specific sectors of the industrial economy? All this is a tremendous co-optation and a co-optation that is not actually helpful. And it's really a response to peak oil is what the whole climate change movement. I'm not talking about grassroots climate change movement. I'm talking about the NGO climate change movement.
Yeah.
It's really more of a response to peak oil because, okay, not many people know this, but I did most of the coursework toward a degree, a master's in mineral economics. And then I got sick of it and quit. And one of the, it was one of the most sane things I ever did. Anyway, the quitting was, and
yeah, yeah.
one of the things, the basics of mineral economics are that you get the easily accessible ore first, and then the more expensive ore, and then the more expensive ore.
Mm.
Same thing worked with energy. You get the easily accessible energy first. You know, you get the oil that you can scoop up first, and then after that you get the oil that you have to drill 10 feet for, and then you get the oil that you have to drill 100 feet for, and then after that you get the oil that you have to drill 1,000 feet for, and then you get the oil that's offshore, and then you get the tar sands. You keep going to lower and lower quality because economically it makes most sense. I mean, look, if you're going to eat a donut, if you really want a donut, and there's a donut on the counter right in front of you, and there's also a donut that is out in the garage, except clean, you're going to grab the one right in front of you first. I mean, it's just common sense.
Yeah.
And so what we're seeing is those in power recognize, I mean, those who are in charge of the oil, the energy industries recognize that they need to have a transition to other forms of energy because oil has passed its peak and it's slowly declining. And how does capitalism work? It works with subsidies. How do they get subsidies? By scaring the hell out of people and telling them global warming is going to kill you if you don't change over to wind and solar. And I'm not saying global warming isn't going to kill us. I'm not saying that at all.
Mm.
What I'm saying is wind and solar are not going to save us. They're not even going to save the damn economy. But which is something we can get into later or another time because we're running out of time. But the real point here is that A, what Al Gore says is the right thing is not what I think is the right thing. B, okay, can you ask me the question again?
Yeah, basically, it seems to be kind of more like a question about bargaining and denial, and it's kind of the example that scientists and people like Al Gore believe we can fix this if we do the right thing. So it's a question about what is the right thing.
Well, for me, the right thing is is stopping all industrial culture. And everybody gets so scared and they say, oh my God, that's so terrible, Derek. You want to kill 6 billion people. But that's not true. And I asked Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the industrial economy and the global economy disappeared tomorrow. I said, of course, absolutely. There are subsistence farmers who are being driven off their land by Coca-Cola right now. And they would be fine. Most of the human beings on the planet don't have access to electricity right now. If the grid goes down, they are not harmed. In fact, they are helped because no longer can transnational corporations steal their land. And then I asked Vandana Shiva, I said, okay, I understand that this is true for the rural poor of India. What about the urban poor? What about the people in Mumbai? Wouldn't they be totally screwed if the industrial economy went down tomorrow? And she said, absolutely not. The reason these people are in the slums in Mumbai is because they were forced off their land. And without the industrial economy to have the military that supports the land theft from them, they would move back to the countryside in a heartbeat. And so when we talk about, yes, people in the United States and the UK will be will not be very happy when we lose our comforts or elegancies, especially.
Yeah.
And this is also another part that's really important to this is the people who say, gosh, Derek, you want to kill, you know, all the humans on the planet because you want to bring down civilization. It's like, look, civilization's going to crash anyway, whether or not we bring it down. It's going to crash through peak oil, through global warming, through capitalism destroying the planet, or through brave women and men working in concert with the planet to bring it down. It's going to come down somehow or another. And so if your concern is primarily for the humans who will be alive during and after the crash, then what you need to do, instead of complaining at me for stating the obvious, you need to help prepare people for the crash.
Yep.
So if that's your primary concern, go for it. I'm not saying that was that person's primary concern. I'm saying this is a critique I get all the time. You asked me what was the right thing to do. The right thing to do for the planet. Here, it's really easy. As soon as you start to look at everything from the perspective of, okay, what would be best for the fish who still live in the Thames River? What would be best for the birds, the seabirds who still live off the northern coast of Britain? I mean, it's pretty obvious that they need for industrial fishing to stop. I mean, let's think about this for a second. I know salmon here. What do salmon need to survive? What they need is for dams to be removed. What they need is for industrial logging to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. They need for global warming to stop, which means they need for the entire economy to stop. And they need for the oceans not to be murdered. When people say, how can we save the salmon? They're not actually asking any of those questions. What they're asking is, how can we save the salmon without doing any of those things?
Yeah.
And the answer is, can't. So for me, the key, the absolute key, is to make your loyalty to the land. And once you start looking at it from the land's perspective, it really becomes a lot more easy. But once again, if that makes you really mad at me because I care about the frogs and I recognize the frogs cannot survive this culture, and you want for humans to be able to have a soft landing, which I wish for with every cell in my body, but it's not going to happen, then what you need to do is prepare people for that crash.
Yeah, totally agree with that, Derek. And you know, you touched on the subject of renewable energy there. We were talking about Al Gore. We were talking about the big NGOs. I'd just like to point listeners to a couple of things on YouTube by Derek, which goes into these things in slightly more detail. One's called Power versus Energy, and the other one is called Activists to Lobbyists. So the Power of versus Energy one is obviously about renewables and the fallacy of renewables being upscalable and the lies that are told about how successful renewables are. And the Activists to Lobbyists one is about the co-option of the NGOs and indeed people like Al Gore. We had a strange question just to lighten it a wee bit. We had a couple of people asking about your wardrobe, Derek.
Okay.
I take it I don't mean to in any way insult you. In fact, it's a compliment. But I take it you've got a minimalist wardrobe. Would that be correct?
What does minimalist mean? In this case.
In this case, it means you don't have rows and rows of shoes and rows of jumpers and rows of t-shirts and, you know.
No, this is, okay, this is kind of embarrassing, but, okay, I have two pair of shoes. That's it.
Right. So have I.
Plus, because I live in a rainforest, yeah. I also have a pair of rubber boots that,
yeah.
So two pair of shoes and rubber boots. And so far as the other, I actually do have a lot of t-shirts. The reason I have a lot of t-shirts is because I have this weird, this is just a weird thing with me that I don't really talk about in public, but I am here, which is that if I get a t-shirt, if somehow I have a shirt, I can't throw it away. I have to wear it out or I have to give it to somebody who wants it.
Yeah.
And so I still have t-shirts from 1985.
Right.
That it's like, please hurry up and wear out so I can turn you into rags. So I do have a lot of shirts. But I don't buy a lot of shirts. It's just I keep them for a long time.
Yeah. I know where you're coming from. I'm very similar to that. I've got cupboards full of stuff, which I basically don't wear. But one of the questioners was saying that you seem to wear the same t-shirt all the time. Now, do you have replicas of a certain t-shirt?
Well, I wonder if you're talking about my Benista shirt. I have several Benista shirts. I don't wear the same one. I have several Benista shirts. I did a couple books with my friend Stephanie McMillan. She's an artist and she has some illustrations in the book too. Anyway, she made a whole bunch of t-shirts and she had more than she wanted and she was giving them away. So it's like, okay, yeah, I'll take them. That'd be great. And I've been proudly wearing Benista shirts, but I have several. No, I don't wear the same shirt until nobody can come within 30 feet of me.
Right.
But I will have to admit, I mean, my fashion sense is pretty close to non-existent.
Yeah.
I will acknowledge this with neither pride nor shame.
Well, that's it then. I mean, enough said, you know.
I do love my sweaters. People comment on the sweaters.
Yeah.
And I do want to mention that my mom, I've got probably 20 of those sweaters with different designs on them that my mom, she takes a regular sweater and then she count stitches the design onto it. And I love those sweaters.
Yeah. That's nice. Yeah. Aww. Jennifer, have you got something?
Can we make this, either this or the next, the last question?
Yeah, sure thing, Derek.
Sure.
And we can certainly do this again another time.
Go for it, Jennifer.
Okay, Derek, you know, we want to talk a little bit about dams, and there's a question from Josh Diamond, and he wants to hear you wax eloquent on the existence of dams and the wretched labeling they've got as being clean and green.
Oh, that pisses me off. Not the question, the reality. We hear, this is one of the bright green lies that we hear that dams, you know, some countries like Costa Rica or Norway or other countries are going to renewable electricity, except they say renewable energy, but there's the first lie is what they mean is so-called renewable electricity. And the reason that's important is because electricity only makes 20% of counts for about 20% of energy usage. And so you have all these cities in the United States are saying Atlanta is pledging to go 100% renewable energy. No, it's not. It's pledging to go 100% so-called renewable electricity. And that's a huge difference. They keep saying that this means they'll actually say, okay, all these cities making this pledge mean we can run the economy on renewables. It's like, no, you're not accounting for 80%. I want to say this again. They're saying they're confusing the words energy and electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care if somebody walking down the street or if I go to the grocery store and somebody in the grocery store confuses the word energy and electricity. I don't care. I'm not that much of a pedant. But when somebody who is working for the Sierra Club is putting out a press release saying we know we can go renewable because these cities are doing 100% renewable energy, somebody doing that needs to know the difference. And the same is true, by the way, of Naomi Klein, who has repeatedly said Munich, for example, is going to 100% renewable energy. No, it's not. And it's – if you're going to speak – if you're going to be a public figure speaking in public about this issue, you need to use your words correctly because it's incredibly misleading. And almost everybody's doing it. Maybe one article out of 20 will say this correctly. If they say – going to 100% quote renewable power, that's a different thing because power is electricity. Anyway, so first off, when a country, when they say Costa Rica is going 100% renewable energy, complete crap. Because they're not making all their boilers run on electricity. This is 20%. Second, a lot of this in many countries like Norway and Costa Rica is hydro, and Bhutan is another one that they say all the time. And hydro not only is incredibly harmful to – it kills rivers. It kills the fish runs, the fish who need to run up and down. It kills them. It kills – it deprives the areas lower, including beaches, of sediment. And it can destroy – the sediment can go hundreds of miles from the mouth of the river. And that's absolutely crucial to rebuilding beaches. Right after the Elwha Dam was removed up in the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State in the United States – there was a rocky beach that within a year or two became sandy again, and it became an oyster bed again, as it had been forever before the putting in the dam. It's incredibly destructive to that. Kootenai sturgeon have not reproduced on their own since they put in the Libby Dam back in the, God, I don't know, 60 years ago. Dams, so they stop the movement of fish. They stop the movement of nutrients. They turn cold, fast-flowing rivers into slow-moving reservoirs. Fish who try to move downstream are often pureed by the turbines, or either they're pureed or they die of the bends, because when they go through them, the pressure changes so much that they die. A horribly painful death. And it makes it so fish who like warm reservoirs live there, invasive fish, and the native fish who like cold, faster running rivers are no longer able to be there. Those are some of the problems. And in addition, they call dams, what is one of the terms for them? People who really know, people who are not slaves to the industrial, to the solar and to the so-called renewable industry. They are called, what's the term people use? Methane bombs, because they produce so much methane. It ends up that, here, let me find this. Dams have been called methane bombs and methane factories because they emit so much of that potent greenhouse gas methane. They're the largest single anthropogenic source, accounting for 23% of all methane emitted because of humans. Dams can release up to 3.5 times as much atmospheric carbon per unit of energy as is released by burning oil. Primarily because, as an article in New Scientist pointed out, quote, large amounts of carbon tied up in trees and other plants are released when the reservoirs initially flood and the plants rot. Then after the first pulse of decay, plant matter settling on the reservoir's bottom decomposes without oxygen, resulting in a buildup of dissolved methane. This is released into the atmosphere and water passes through the dam's turbines. From the perspective of the health of the planet, the best thing we can say about dams is that eventually they fail. And to the degree that the river is still alive at that point, it will do its best to recover. So the point is that even on the level of – this is one reason that all of this so-called renewable charge makes me so angry, because the planet's being killed and they're doing these accounting shenanigans. Oh, another great example – and this is away from dams, is biomass. Biomass, yeah. That's another form of, when they talk about renewable energy.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're talking about biomass, and all biomass is either cutting down forests and burning them, mm-hmm. or it is growing crops, harvesting them, and burning them. And that's considered renewable, and it's considered green. And there are 29, I think it is, 27 or 29 pulp mills in the southeastern United States that are running 24 hours a day to export wood pellets to the UK. So it's your fault. Anyway, to
well, it's not the UK, Derek. It's the disunited kingdom.
Yeah, there we go. It's to Europe.
Yeah.
To burn air. And here's the thing I want to get to about biomass is that biomass is considered to be carbon free.
Yes.
That you could cut down a forest and burn it and they don't count those carbon emissions as counting. Why? Because they say that the forest will eventually regrow in 100 years.
Yeah.
So first off, it may not grow. Second, can you imagine any accounting firm in the world that would get by with saying our books are balanced because we're spending money right now and we're going to get this money back in 100 years?
Yeah.
They would be put in prison for fraud so fast. Yet this is the sort of crap that happens every single day in this renewable rush. It is complete crap. And by the way, the biomass accounts for way, way more. There's problems with wind and solar we can talk about another time, in their manufacture especially, but other reasons too. But when they talk about, for example, the German miracle of solar and wind, most of the so-called renewable energy comes from biomass, and most of the increase in it comes from biomass. Between 1990 and 2015, so-called biomass in Germany had increased 35 times, and it's now a major use of land. 2 million hectares is devoted to crop-based biofuels. That's 17% of the arable land and 6% of the total land in Germany. And meanwhile, it cuts down forests in United States, Canada, South Africa, Germany, Sweden, Czech Republic, Norway, Russia, Belarus, Ukraine. A bunch of other countries are being cut down to fuel that. This is just another excuse to murder the planet, and it's not helpful.
Yeah. I mean, a little bit more of you going into that subject, Derek, can be found on Power V's Energy if you go to YouTube. Derek goes into a situation in Germany in some more detail. I think you've had a fair crack at the whip there, Derek, and I'm just going to finish with a comment from one of our folks on the Near Term Human Extinction Support Group. She just wants to thank you for your book Dreams, and she's reading it for a second time, and she wants to ask for new people, which of your books should they read first? An answer in 5 seconds.
If they're more hardcore, then start with Endgame, and if they want a slightly gentler introduction, start with Language Older Than Words.
Right. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, your research is phenomenal, and the depth of which you look into the issues which other people you mentioned Naomi Klein, for instance, just don't go there and accept, ridiculous figures for renewable energy and such and biomass and all the other things, all the way you've answered all the other questions has just been wonderful, mate. You've certainly got a gift for the gab, as we'd say here. But the gab is all quality. So just thanks from the bottom of my heart, Derek, for being on Extinction Radio.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your work, and thank you for your fabulous questions.
Yeah, and also a thanks to Jennifer.
And thank you, Derek. It's really been a pleasure talking with you tonight.
Thank you. Let's do it again.
Yeah, well, let's do it again. Let's talk about monsters a bit more again,
Great.
Once the book's out, we'll be able to comment a bit more about it. Anyway, thanks, Derek, and speak soon, yeah?
Yep, thank you so much.
Cheers, mate. Bye.
Bye.
searching. Keep on searching. Keep on searching.